Jesus left that place and went to the vicinity of Tyre. He entered a house and did not want anyone to know it, yet he could not keep his presence secret. In fact, as soon as she heard about him, a woman whose little daughter was possessed by an impure spirit came and fell at his feet. The woman was a Greek born in Syria, Phoenicia. She begged Jesus to drive the demon out of her daughter. First, let the children eat all they want, he told her, for it is not right to take the children's bread and toss it to the dogs. Lord, she replied, even the dogs under the table eat the children's crumbs. Then he told her, for such a reply, you may go. The demon has left your daughter. She went home and found her child lying on the bed, and the demon was gone. Then Jesus left the vicinity of Tyre and went through Sidon, down to the Sea of Galilee and into the region of the Decapolis. There some people brought to him a man who was deaf and could hardly talk, and they begged Jesus to place his hand on him. After he took him aside, away from the crowd, Jesus put his fingers into the man's ears. Then he spit and touched the man's tongue. He looked up to heaven and with a deep sigh said to him, Ephphatha, Ephphatha, which means be opened. At this, the man's ears were opened, his tongue was loosened, and he began to speak plainly. Jesus commanded them not to tell anyone, but the more he did so, the more they kept talking about it. People were overwhelmed with amazement. He has done everything well, they said. He even makes the deaf hear and the mute speak.
Like most parents, I've spent a lot of time over the years reading picture books to my children. And I like some of them. I think some of them are really good. If I'm honest, some of them I find quite boring, especially the ones that tend to have a very predictable story arc. You can kind of be rest assured that any tension that's introduced in the story is going to be neatly resolved by the end. So some of the tactics I've used over the years to try to survive bedtime story is to take some liberty with the story, to go off script, to do some imaginative ad-libbing, and to take the story on an unexpected turn. And sometimes that means killing off one of the main characters in the picture book. Other times it means putting some outrageous things in the mouth of the main character. And usually when that happens, there's a look of surprise on my children's face as if something unexpected, something jarring has happened in the story. This doesn't make sense. Followed by, oh, you're messing with us, Dad, aren't you? And at that point, they have to decide, do you want the warm, fuzzy, safe, predictable story that gets tied at the end with a neat bow, or do you want the story that's possibly heading off into an unknown and dangerous direction? And when you come to this story about the Syrophoenician woman, which is the passage I'm going to focus on, it feels a bit like Mark has gone off script, like Mark's begun to ad-lib, like Mark's begun to mess with one of our main characters, like he's begun to mess with Jesus. If you want to look at the passage again, if you don't think it's a little startling, look back again. Who is this guy? He sounds antisocial. He sounds surly. He sounds abrasive. He refuses a request from a desperate woman and then seemingly calls her a dog. And there's this feeling of, Mark, are you messing with us? And I think there's a tendency and all of us, I think especially us preachers, is you want to come in and you want to iron out all the difficulties and assure everyone that this, with a little bit of work, a little bit of exegesis, we can iron out these difficulties and we can get this story back on a comfortable track. The problem is the Bible is not a warm and fuzzy storybook. It doesn't have neat and tidy story arcs and lessons. And I want to argue that that is very good news. Because one, it would be pretty boring, one. But even more, it wouldn't reflect reality. For example, I've never seen a caterpillar eat a slice of chocolate cake. Never once. But I've seen desperate mothers who will go to any length for the sake of their child. I have heard stories of people who have come to Jesus begging him. And I myself have been very confused at times by what Jesus is saying. So if you found this picture of Jesus troubling, I want to say, don't be troubled by your trouble. And secondly, don't be afraid to wrestle with this passage. I think oftentimes we want the Bible to be something that it's not. We want the Bible to be neat and tidy and efficient and have a nice, simple lesson. And it's not. And I think, I was reflecting on this week, I think the more I recognize that struggle is part of reading scripture, I recognize that that's actually part of the transformation purpose. That's often in the struggle that we're transformed. So I invite you to kind of struggle with me through this odd scene of Jesus interacting with the Syrophoenician woman. If you want to follow along, we're in Mark 7, 24. Jesus left that place and went into the vicinity of Tyre. He entered a house and did not want anyone to know it, yet he could not keep his presence secret. So Tyre would be modern day Lebanon. It's to the north and west of Galilee. And I want you to notice a few things here about this area that we've moved into. One is, first, Jesus is leaving Jewish territory and moving into Gentile territory. And not only that, he's moving into a territory that has this long history of antagonism with Israel. So Josephus is a Jewish historian, and he wrote about the inhabitants of Tyre as notoriously our bitterest enemies. So not only that, but this oftentimes Tyre was considered the most extreme expression of paganism that they could encounter. So this is a really surprising move. Jesus is moving out of Jewish territory into a place that's inhabited by some of their most bitter enemies and known for their paganism. So why is Jesus doing this? Why is Jesus even going to Tyre? We're not exactly sure. If you're here with us last week, we saw a rather tense encounter that Jesus had with religious leaders. And remember, these oftentimes we hear Pharisees, we hear religious leaders, and we immediately think bad guys. But remember, these are Jesus' people. If Jesus were to identify with any group of these Jewish groups at the time, it's probably the Pharisees that he has the most in common with. So that's hard. I mean, think about it. And oftentimes it's those intra-conflicts that are the most challenging. And so is Jesus looking for some quiet space to go process this? He also might have been looking to lay low. I mean, he's in this encounter with these religious leaders. He said some pretty risky things. Whatever reason, he goes to kind of lay low, but that doesn't work. His magnetism, even in far off Tyre, is too much. A woman catches word that he's there. She goes to him and falls at his feet. She has a daughter who has an impure spirit, and she begs Jesus to drive the demon out. So of all the people that approach Jesus in Mark's gospel, this one probably has the most going against her. She, again, is from this famously pagan region. She's a woman. She's a Gentile. And we talked about impurity and defilement last week. The thing to know about for Gentiles is that they weren't impure necessarily because they broke food laws or they didn't wash their hands. They were impure because they were Gentiles. They were innately impure. So even for Levi, in Matthew's account, he has the disciples nearby. So we can kind of imagine the disciples are probably there. Even Levi, the tax collector, probably raises his eyebrows at this. So I want you to notice that for this encounter to happen, all kinds of barriers have to be kind of busted through. Gender, ethnicity, religion, all of these have to be broken through for this encounter to happen. But the woman is desperate. She reminds me of the desperate woman in our story a couple chapters ago who bled for 12 years and who was willing to risk everything to touch Jesus' cloak. She's also the same person in that story, Jairus. She's desperate like Jairus. In fact, she's the first person to fall at Jesus' feet in Mark's gospel since Jairus did that and pled on behalf of his daughter. So the woman begs Jesus. And she doesn't just beg Jesus. The Greek here is progressive. It's more like she kept on begging Jesus. She won't take no for an answer. She's desperate. And when I studied this passage, with a few people from Midway. My sister was in town and somebody had to cancel from Midway. So I invited her to come study the passage, which is great because, you know, I read this passage and thought about bedtime stories. But my sister, who's a mom to two boys, she was like, yeah, that's what you do as a mom. Your kid's sick, you do whatever you got to do for your child. And I was like, oh yeah, that's right. I think I'd missed how much of this woman is desperate on behalf of her child's well-being. She has this fierce motherly love that when a mother reads this passage, they almost immediately recognize. It's a love that won't take no for an answer when the child's well-being is on the line. So Jesus responds to the woman. First, let the children eat all they want, for it is not right to take the children's bread and toss it to the dogs. So this is the part, this is really strange. This is really odd. This does not sound like the Jesus we know. It sounds like Jesus is refusing a request of a desperate woman. And like I said, not only that, it sounds like he's calling her a dog, essentially. And so in our culture, it's not okay to call someone a dog. I think for the most part, we love dogs. I've met people, I think, that would prefer the company of dogs to people. But nobody wants to be called a dog in our culture. And in the Jewish tradition, it's even worse. Dogs were considered despicable and insolent and the most miserable of creatures. They were associated with uncleanness. They ate garbage and other dead animals. So in their mind, you know, dog is a mangy, unkept mongrel who for a lot of the Jewish people is the perfect descriptor of people in Tyre, ignorant, godless, pagan idolaters. Now, I said I wasn't going to iron out all the difficulties, but I think we can do this a little bit. So the word here is actually, in Greek, is actually the diminutive form of dogs. So it's something closer to puppies, which helps a little. I mean, yeah. So you hear it this way. First, let the children eat all they want, for it is not right to take the children's bread and toss it to the puppies. It helps a little. It still sounds like a derogatory slur. I don't think any of us want to be called a puppy. But even if we can get over that obstacle, we've still got other obstacles. It still seems very out of character for a generous and compassionate Savior. Jesus sounds kind of cold. He sounds unmoved by the begging. It sounds like he's saying, hey, wait your turn. No, time's not right. I can't do what you're asking me to do. So the Jewish people considered themselves the children of God. You see in this line that Jesus says, children, they had the Torah, they had the law. They were in this covenant relationship with God. They were the children of God. And so in our little story, the Gentiles would be the dogs. And Jesus seems to be saying, my mission is first to the Jewish people. They've got to eat all they want first. So it isn't that Jesus is necessarily saying, I'm excluding Gentile people from the bread, from the good news about the kingdom that's breaking in. But he does seem to say, wait your turn. It's not your time for this bread. The priority is first to Israel. So what is Jesus doing here? There's been lots of speculation, as you can imagine, by interpreters and people who have studied scripture on what is happening. Some people say Jesus is testing this woman. Some people say what you need to do is see Jesus saying with kind of a gleam in his eye, like he's got a smile on his face. Like, I'll gladly hear your daughter, but can you pass this test? And that might be what's happening. I think it's certainly possible, but maybe not. Maybe Jesus is saying no. The woman responds, Lord, even the dogs under the table eat the children's crumbs. So I think if at any point in the exchange Jesus smiles, it's right here. I think it's right here that there's the gleam in his eye. Because it's at this point, he hears the woman's response and he thinks, oh, that was good. I wasn't expecting that. See, if I place myself in the story, I think at this point, I've asked for my request. I've essentially been turned down. And I want to say, like, hey, Jesus, I understand. I'll let you back to your secrecy. But remember, she has a daughter back home that's being tortured by this demon. And this woman is not going to take no for an answer. But she doesn't say, hey, Jesus, that's not fair. You've got to heal my daughter. What does she do? This is really, I think this is the key to understanding this story. She doesn't back down. She doesn't say that's not fair. She responds within the parable. So Jesus, you know, obviously he's not talking about literal dogs and literal bread and literal children, right? He's making a comparison like parables do. We talked about the children are the Jews, the Gentiles are the puppies. The bread is Jesus and his message, and it has to be fed to the Jewish people first. And she responds, I get that. But even the puppies under the table, even us Gentiles, can feed on the crumbs falling off the table. So think about the pattern we've seen in Mark's gospel so far. Jesus will tell a parable, and how do the disciples usually respond? We don't get it. We don't understand what you're saying. And then Jesus usually gets exasperated, and why are you so dull? Are you ever going to understand a parable? We don't get it. We don't understand. Is there a Cliff Notes version of this parable? It's a bit like a poet reading a poem, and someone raises their hand and says, but what does it mean? What does the poem mean? Can you boil the meaning down to one line? Like, if you want to exasperate a poet or probably someone who teaches poetry, ask that question. What does it mean? And there may be space. Kevin would be able to speak to this, and Christiana much better than I would. There may be a space to talk about the meaning of poem, but where's the power in a poem? The power's in the poem. It's not in the explanation of the poem. And Jesus tells a parable, and for the first time in Mark's gospel, rather than I don't understand, he gets someone who answers within the parable. She gets it. She sees herself in the parable. And also think about when do parables start to exert their power on you? It's when you enter into them. Let me explain. You can kind of take Jesus' parable, especially in Luke, and kind of try to boil them down to a message. But that's not near as powerful as if you see yourself in that story. So take for example, the parable of the prodigal son. This is one of Jesus' most well-known parables. The power is not really in a preacher like me standing up here and saying, you know, God forgives sinners, just like this younger brother, or you really shouldn't be judgmental like that older brother. The real power in that story is when all of a sudden you realize I'm the younger brother. I'm the one who's fled God. I'm the one who squandered everything. I'm in a pigsty right now. Or I'm the older brother. I did everything right. I never disobeyed. I'd always followed the rules. And I am standing outside of this party and I'm bitter. Or I'm the father. I'm the one scanning the horizon for that lost child. That's when that power, that parable begins to really move you. It exerts power on you. It begins to claim you. It's when you see yourself inside of that parable. And that's what's happening with this woman. And she not only enters into the parable, she does it in a very clever manner. So one of the things you miss in English that she's doing that's quite clever is that she changes the word from children. So Jesus uses the word children, and he uses the word technon. He says, let the technon eat, which in Greek tends to refer to biological children. And then she responds, and she uses the word children again, but she changes up the term, and she uses the word paideon, which is another word from children, but it's more inclusive. It implies both the children and the servants of the household. So she seems to understand the mercies of God, the bread on the table. It isn't just for the biological children. It isn't just for the Jewish people. It's for others too. And notice how she recognizes this is some potent bread. One person, a commentator, paraphrased it this way. Look, mister, I'm not asking for a seat at the table. My daughter is suffering. All I need from you is a crumb or two. I know it will do the job, but I'm going to need it now. See, the woman recognizes there's power in this bread. She seems to somehow recognize that the food which Jesus is bringing the Jewish people, whether they recognize it or not, and many don't, is both abundant and powerful. It's interesting that this exchange happens between the two miraculous feedings of the 4,000 and 5,000 and 4,000 in Mark. So next week, you'll hear preached on the feeding of the 4,000. And in each of those stories, Jesus feeds the people, and we read that they ate all they wanted and were satisfied. And in both stories, there's leftovers. So the children have been fed. They've eaten all they wanted. But the bread that Jesus is bringing them is so abundant, it's just spilling off the table. You see, what Jesus isn't just bringing a meal, he's bringing a feast. And when Jesus feeds the children, it reminds me of the great feast in Harry Potter that is served to the children of Hogwarts at the beginning of the term. The food just keeps coming and coming and coming. The woman recognizes that Jesus is bringing such a feast that this table cannot contain it all. She accepts what Jesus says. Okay, salvation comes first to the Jews. She affirms what Paul will later say in Romans, that gospel and salvation comes first to the Jew, then to the Gentile. But she trusts that this feast is so abundant. There's so much superabundance. There's so much potency in this bread that's going to spill over to people like her. She doesn't need a catered meal. She just needs a few crumbs. And Jesus is amazed. He spent all this time, he's trying to teach his disciples who just time and time again don't seem to get it. And yet in one sentence, this woman gets it. She understands Jesus' mission. And he says, "For such a reply, you may go. The demon has left your daughter." So what do we learn from this woman? First, we learn that the woman approaches Jesus boldly. Again, I said there's all kinds of obstacles which should have stopped this woman. Her gender, her ethnicity, her religion. She approaches Jesus in this yet bold and persistent manner. She's really pretty tenacious. I think some of what maybe makes us uncomfortable about this story is the way Jesus responds. But I think some of it, if we really sit and think about it, what might make us uncomfortable is that we get this impression that she might have changed Jesus' mind. That the woman begs Jesus to heal her daughter, and Jesus says, "No, not now." She won't take no for an answer. And in the end, she gets what she came from. So the two seem to be contending. They seem to be kind of sparring here, struggling a bit. And I think some of us are like, that's not the way it's supposed to work with God. That's not the way we're supposed to approach God. And there's some balance. We have lots of scriptures to also inform how we approach God. But I don't think this is totally unprecedented. Think back in the Old Testament. Think back to when the story in Genesis when Abraham pleads on behalf of the righteous in the city of Sodom. Do you all remember that story? It's pretty well-known story. God is saying to Abraham, "I'm going to destroy this city." And Abraham says, "Are you sure you want to do that? Like, are you sure you want to wipe away the righteous with the wicked? Like, what if there's 50? What if there's 50 righteous people? Would you spare this town for 50? And God says, "Okay, if I find 50 righteous people, I'll spare the city of Sodom." But Abraham doesn't stop there, does he? This is when you're reading, you're like, wow, Abraham is bold. He says, "Now that I've been so bold, though I am dust and ashes, what about 45 people? God says, "Okay, for 45, I will not destroy it. What about 40? What about 30? What about 20? What about for the sake of 10? And God says, "For the sake of 10, I will not destroy it." This woman's a little like a female Abraham. She's boldly pleading, not on behalf of a city, but on behalf of her daughter. And she's also a little like a female Jacob. Could you put up that first slide? I love this quote by James Edwards. This is his commentary. Okay. "Within the parable, she has met a living Lord with whom she has struggled and contended. She has sparred with Jesus as Jacob sparred with God at Peniel. Your name will no longer be Jacob, but Israel, because you have struggled with God and with men and have overcome." She is a female Jacob. She too has overcome. So this woman, I mean, James Edwards kind of says it. She's sparred with Jesus. She's sparred like Jacob did. And I started out by saying this story is not a children's story, because children's stories don't tend to reflect reality. This story reflects reality. One of the people who found great comfort in the story was actually Martin Luther. Martin Luther contended with God. He struggled with God a lot. I think this story, if you've contended, if you've struggled with God, I think you find a comfort because it's such an honest portrayal of that struggle with God. Faith is a struggle because life is a struggle. Because a lot of times we look at what's happening in our life and we say, "I don't get it. This does not make sense." Everything that happens in life doesn't get wrapped up at the end of the story, does it? It doesn't get a bow tied on at the end. And in this passage, we're given permission to boldly come before God, to even encounter God, to even struggle with God like Jacob, and to say, I'm not leaving until I get the blessing. I think we need to be reminded of that. That we can boldly approach God. We can boldly approach Jesus. That Jesus is not troubled by what troubles us. That he'd much rather struggle with us than us walk away with him from him. In part because he knows that's where the transformation happens. It's within the struggle that we are transformed. But the woman doesn't only approach Jesus boldly. She approaches him with humbly. I think this is really the key to understanding this. Many of us would have been too proud to enter into this story. We're not puppy dogs. We don't eat crumbs off the table. I think a lot of us are too proud to enter into this story. Like we're not going to beg for something. But this woman has no qualms falling at Jesus' feet. She has no qualms receiving the kingdom of God like a little puppy. She doesn't approach Jesus and say, "You give me what I'm owed." She comes to Jesus boldly, but she does it with incredible humility. She's like Abraham, who both goes to God boldly and yet says, "I'm dust and ashes." Dwight Moody is reported to have said that Jesus sent no one away empty except for those that were full of themselves. Jesus sent no one away empty except for those who were full of themselves. The people Jesus sends away are not the people who recognize how needy they are. It's the people who think how great I am. This woman is such a beautiful model, I think, of how to approach God with boldness and yet humility. She knows Jesus has power, and she knows she's at his mercy, and she doggedly clings to him. She doggedly clings to him until she gets the blessing, until she gets what she needs. I think one of the requirements of being a disciple of Jesus is humility. Pride is going to make it really hard for you to bow. Pride does not make the knees bow. Pride does not bring us to bow before Jesus like this woman. What brought this woman before Jesus? It was her desperation. So I studied this passage with a few people from Midway, and Sherry was actually part of that group. By the way, if you're part of Midway, at some point you're going to receive an invitation to come study a passage from Mindy. I just want to encourage you to say yes. It's been such a rich and helpful experience to gather around the passage with people from Midway. So I want to throw out that plug. If you haven't received an invitation yet, we're just going through and inviting everyone. So, but one of the things Sherry pointed out was, as we were studying it, was that she thought it was significant that the woman begged Jesus. And she noticed in both these stories that each of the people beg Jesus for something. And as she was saying that, I was thinking about it, I don't know if I've ever been in a desperate situation where I've been forced to beg for something. I mean, if you think about it, like our culture, to be a responsible person, we should never have to beg for anything. And so I'm kind of thinking out this loud, reflecting on how I don't remember a time. And Sherry said, "I begged God once." She said, "When Kevin had his heart attack, I begged God not to take him from us." She said, "It was the worst moment of my life. It was a desperate moment." If you had time to sit here, I think you could think back on your life and remember a desperate moment where you didn't know anything else to do but to beg God. Life isn't like a picture book, is it? It's so much more harrowing than a picture book. And none of us seek those desperate moments. And yet, if we live long enough, they're going to come to us. And in the story, the woman is driven to her knees by a desperate situation, a situation that none of us would seek. And yet she leaves with a blessing. It's at this nexus of desperation and having no other option but to cling to Jesus, to cry out to God, that her faith is formed. That trusting in Jesus isn't something she's just doing in her mind. She's doing it on her knees. The woman is bold, and she's humble, and she is desperate. There's one last thing that the woman teaches us. She teaches us about faith. She goes, if you notice, she goes to Jesus in faith. She has faith that Jesus will do something, and she leaves in faith. And that the leaving in faith is a little hard to notice, but remember, Jesus says the demon is out, doesn't ask any more questions. She's out of there. She has faith that when Jesus said it's done, it's done. You know, back a few chapters ago when I was preaching on that story of the woman who's bled for 12 years in Jairus, I said, the woman is teaching the synagogue leader, Jairus, what faith looks like. In the last story from last week, we had these biblical scholars of the day, the esteemed theologians of the day, the Pharisees and the teachers of the law, and they're sparring with Jesus. They're contending with Jesus, and they don't get it. And Jesus says, you're missing it. And now we have this woman from a despised ethnic group, this most unlikely of people, who's showing us what faith looks like. As one person puts it, she's a theologian, but her theology doesn't come from books. It is expression of painfully experienced need and fierce motherly love. Her theology is coming out of her pain and her desperate love as a mother. And very often, the older I get, the more I recognize that the people in the eyes of society, in the eyes of themselves that think they have it most together, often are really struggling in their faith. And often the people that society looks at and says they're desperate, they got nothing for them, if you start to talk to them, their faith is rock solid. Look at this woman. Learn from this woman. Come to God boldly. Don't be afraid to struggle with God. And yet come to God humbly. Cling to him in desperation, trusting like the woman did, that in this faith and trust, you will emerge with a blessing.